the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy has come to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Joshua Kalancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Previously, he was a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a fellow at the University of Southern California Center on Public Diplomacy, and a fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's also served as a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer to Mother Jones. He's the author of Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, and his latest book just out is Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Kalancic.
Thanks so much for having me.
And your book is a wake-up call in as much as even the middle class, which has traditionally been the bulwark of democracy, is turning against democracy in such places as Thailand, Venezuela, Pakistan, the Philippines, and Taiwan. But I think in terms of the news, if you will, nothing is more obvious than what is happening in Russia now, where Putin has gone after the NGOs, 2,000 of them are being harassed, and of course he's now brought up some trumped-up embezzlement charges against leading opposition leader Alexei Navalny. These charges, of course, were thrown out earlier by another trumped-up court case. So let's start with Russia. What's happening there in terms of a reversal of democracy, in terms of what you're suggesting in your book? Because it seems so much easier just to sort of lay it all at Putin's feet.
Well, I mean, I think that there is an element in which leadership matters. It was theoretically possible that after Yeltsin stepped down, you could have had a different leader who was more committed to the democratic process than Putin. So leadership is a factor, but also I think you had in the 90s a high degree of disillusionment among middle class and elite people and others in Russia with the weak economic growth, fluctuating economy. Russia almost went bankrupt. And even though it's not necessarily the fault of democracy that Russia had such economic problems, the fault was placed at the feet of democracy. And so Putin took advantage of that somewhat, and he promised a kind of stability, and he most of all promised economic growth, which he's been able to deliver largely because of relatively high oil and gas prices. And he combined that with a strong appeal to nationalism, a strong appeal to aligning himself with the Orthodox Church. You might have seen, for example, that there's now even a revival of Cossacks, which, you know, have a negative term to many people in the U.S., but have a mixed lineage in Russia. But when it comes down to it, there have been a lot of protest movements in Russia, but yet they've really been unable to sort of grab the broader middle class there. And I think that that's suggestive of the fact that the middle class is still pretty happy with Putin and happy with, or happy, perhaps not the right word, but satisfied enough with Putin and what he has delivered that they don't want to go back to what they saw as a democratic failure in the 1990s.
Well, certainly the collapse of the ruble was a traumatic effect, and that was the early days of post communism, early capitalism, and it certainly was not a particularly happy harbinger of things to come. And I believe that that is deeply rooted. That's considered the great trauma. However, the fact that Putin has been able to shut down all of the media and essentially keep the people in a cocoon of ignorance about the rest of the world and about those that are advocating for democracy, they can take to the streets, but they can barely get their voices heard except online, and he's going after them online. So, and similar things are happening now in Venezuela, where the Chavistas have closed down all of the opposition media, including Globovision, which was the last voice of the opposition, having closed down other opposition television networks earlier. So it seems to me that that is pretty hard to, I mean, how can you not connect a free press with democracy?
No, certainly that's true. I mean, Putin hasn't been able to shut everything down because he can't completely control the internet. But certainly you have a problem that I talk about in the book that's similar with Chavez, Putin, and some others I talk about, like Thaksin Shinawat, who was the prime minister of Thailand, in that they've tended to view democracy as solely being elected. And if you get elected, they view it as their right, their province to basically ignore all the other facets of democracy, which we would call the constitutional facets. So that, you know, that means protections of the right of the free press, the freedom of religion, protection of private property, social freedoms, the right to have what we call, you know, a loyal opposition. In other words, there should be essentially an opposition party, and it's not treasonous to have an opposition party. And so they come to define democracy as just votes. And some of those votes are relatively free. Like, I do genuinely believe that Chavez, although the elections were not conducted in the freest environment in the world, I think in the freest environment he still would have won, but he had no regard for the rest of the elements of democracy, like a free press. And so in the book I call these type of people elected autocrats. I think you could put other people in the sort of the same version to some extent, even someone in as wealthy a country as Italy, I would put Berlusconi almost in the same category. So certainly, that's a problem. You have a number of these places where democracy was looked at as an elections, and other institutions weren't built that strongly. And so when a leader came along who was both popular and disregarding of the other institutions, those other institutions, courts, the press, etc., weren't strong enough to stop him.
Again, I'm speaking with Joshua Kalancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also been a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer to Mother Jones, and his latest book just out is Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. So the idea that these autocrats get elected and they believe in democracy in terms of the election that elects them or re-elects them, but they don't believe in democracy when they're voted out, and they don't provide the voters with that opportunity to vote them out. And that's always been attributed in many ways to the Islamists, the idea that in the Islamic world, democracy means one vote, one time. So how much does Mohamed Morsi fit into that mold?
Well, just to go back, I don't actually agree with that. I mean, I don't think that all of the people that I would put into the category of elected autocrats believe that if they were voted out, they shouldn't step down. That would make them truly not even elected autocrats. Then they would be in the category of just an autocrat, like Ethiopia, North Korea, Saddam Hussein, etc. Berlusconi was voted out, and although he has now returned to politics, he did leave when he was voted out. And other people that I talk about in the book, like including Thaksin and his party, I think were they voted out, they would leave. The problem that you also run into that I talk about in the book is a lot of times opponents of these elected autocrats have not chosen elections that are democratic means to try to oust them. So Chavez's opponents tried to coup. Well, that's not going to help. Thaksin's opponents tried to coup. Succeeded. So again, that doesn't contribute. I don't really believe also that there's something inherent in Islam that counters the possibility of democracy. There are a number of countries with Muslim majorities or large Muslim populations that are vibrant democracies. I think that it's still a little too soon to tell about who Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood are. They could be autocrats. They could evolve into something more like you have in Turkey. They're certainly picking up the remnants of an ossified, messed up in many ways, authoritarian system. But I don't think that Islam is any more conducive to autocracy than anything else.
Well, Joshua Kalancic, though, it does seem that there's a connection between those with autocratic tendencies in democracies and the control of the media. I mean, Berlusconi essentially controlled much of, if not most, of the Italian media. Thaksin in Thailand, wasn't he a big media mogul as well?
Yes, I do think that there's a connection, and the connection is that they don't believe in, like I said, they don't believe that in other forms of democracy in other aspects, including freedom of the press, so they buy up a large percentage of the media. I mean, I don't think that it's always true. You don't necessarily have to buy it up. Like in Sri Lanka, the government has just cowed the media, but buying up the media is certainly one way you could do it.
Yeah, well, that's what's just happened in Venezuela now, that the Chavistas have managed to close down Globovision by essentially buying the guy out. And he was the last and the only voice of the opposition. And Putin, I suppose, did Berezovsky get paid for the television networks that Putin took over?
I think he just got exiled. I think that still, that's certainly a significant element. I think many of these people you're talking about are genuinely popular, particularly with middle class and lower class people. Thaksin, for example, won his first election. His party has won every election. Thailand has a relatively free media now. Thaksin is not in control of the media. There is actually quite a lot of opposition to him, and yet they still have continued to win elections. His sister is currently the prime minister. So I think you have a combination of some genuine popularity, leaders with little regard for most elements of democracy, and, you know, in some of these cases at least, control of the media. But in Thailand, for example, the media is not an echo chamber for Thaksin by any means.
So just applying your research, Joshua Kilancic, in your new book, Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government, it hasn't happened here. For example, Rupert Murdoch hasn't been able to take over in the United States, but he certainly did through an emissary, according to Bob Woodward, in a tape that he released through the Washington Post style pages of all places, an extraordinary conversation with an emissary from Roger Ailes to General Petraeus, offering him the presidency on a plate. All he had to do was sign on the dotted line. So where do we stand here in the United States in terms of your overall picture that you're presenting in your new book?
Well, the book doesn't look specifically the United States because there's really significant differences between the United States and any other Western industrialized democracy and some of these countries. So I tried to look at the reversals in lower and middle income countries, but certainly I think the United States has major governance challenges now. No one follows the news doesn't know that. I think that the U.S. has problems of media consolidation, but, you know, I think that the constitutional checks and the institutions that are weak in places like Venezuela or Thailand or even Italy are much stronger in the U.S. I mean, I think that the fact that a guy was elected president in 2000 without the popular vote was highly disputed. Many people thought the Supreme Court ruling was almost farcical because it was a one-time ruling only. But, you know, that opposition was expressed in protests, in discussion in the media. There was nothing like in Thailand or Venezuela or the Philippines. There was no military coup. There was no street protest designed to push Bush out of office. I think that the constitutional system still works. So that's one thing, difference between a more established democracy. And that doesn't have to be only the U.S. I mean, I think that would be true in Germany. That would be true in Sweden. That would be true in India. Secondly, you know, I think that the media consolidation in the U.S. is less to do with control by one person who has political aims, as you've seen in some of these places, than a failure of regulators to prevent consolidation, which allows for greater profit by media companies. I don't think it's anywhere comparable to Berlusconi, Thaksin, and earlier Thaksin, at least, Chavez, something like that. And, you know, I think also the types of media have expanded enough. I mean, that it's unclear whether even these media companies that are so dominant are still going to be so dominant some period in the future from now. So I think the U.S. has certainly got a lot of challenges, but I'm not concerned that democracy is going to fail in the United States.
Well, I was actually thinking also in terms of the notion that the middle class, the normal bulwark for democracy, And you're suggesting in your new book, Joshua Kilancic, Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government, that in many ways the U.S.'s foreign policy is predicated upon the assumption that the middle class undergirds democracy. And I would be interested in the figures of who votes in these countries we're talking about, where autocrats have taken over democratically and have closed off the opposition. I think in Russia, probably more people vote. In Venezuela, I'm sure more people vote than they do in the United States. I mean, we have a voluntary abdication in this country, and I don't know how much of that is attributed to the middle class, but what at the very best, about 60% of the population votes.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. I don't know. It would be hard to draw direct comparisons in some of these cases because some of these countries have mandatory voting. So, but yeah, certainly one of the problems you have in the U.S. is that people opted out of the political system. And it's a similar disillusionment, perhaps, in some of these other countries. All I'm saying is that the means available to people who are disillusioned, and I do think there's a lot of disillusionment in the U.S., and obviously that's given rise to a lot of different things, including the Occupy movement, the Tea Party movement, and all sorts of different things. I just think that with you know some very minor exceptions, the means available to people who are disillusioned with democracy in the United States to change the system are not the same means as, for example, a middle-class or elite person in Thailand who was able to sort of go along with a coup 6 years ago. So I think the disillusionment in the United States is high, but I don't think that, and I think it's bad for the democratic process. I don't think it means that the democracy itself is under threat, I guess I would say, in the United States the way it is, in some places in Southeast Asia, in Russia, even in some places, I think, in Southern Europe, like Greece and Italy.
So just in closing then, Joshua Kilancic, what would reverse this trend short of more media transparency? And we mentioned Russia, for example, that Putin has not yet managed to take over the internet, but you know, the rest of the media spectrum is kind of Putin worship and United Russia worship, as is the case in all of these other countries, particularly now in Venezuela. So I've done coverage on net neutrality, as it's called, rather inadequately here. So there's concern that even our own internet could be corporatized. So is that our great hope?
Media transparency, or
yeah, sorry,
again, I don't think that necessarily corporatized, and what you saw with Berlusconi and Putin is the same thing. I'm not, but no, I mean, I think there are a lot of aspects. For one, I think that just as in these countries, leaders have tended to define elections as the only facet of democracy. Too often, you know, more industrialized democracies, the U.S., Europe, Canada, Japan. All the big players who would sort of sanction the way we talk about sanctions with Iraq, but who would say that a country is on the right path, have tended to also just view elections as the arbiter of whether a country is making a democratic process. And I think we need to step back from that and look at a broader, fuller conception of democracy. Secondly, I think, you know, we have too often ignored democratic reversals. Thailand is a good example. After the coup in 2006, the U.S. really didn't do anything. I mean, we have some laws that Congress has on the books that require that when a country has a coup, we cut off some types of aid, but we did as little as we could, and basically the relationship continued. So that's another. I think also in the countries themselves, you know, you need not only effective leadership, but that leadership, let's say in a good case, like Nelson Mandela in the post-apartheid era, the leadership not only was able to draw on the great support of mostly poor people, but also sort of placate the concerns of middle classes and elites who, whether you like it or not, often are in control of a lot of the capital and the media. And then finally, I think that in a number of these places, the leadership, and you know, the U.S. has a role to play in this too, but needs to probably de-link the idea that democracy is going to bring staggering economic growth, at least at first, because then you're setting people up for a disappointment, And I think a sort of playing down of the expectations of the link between the two is important. They both need to be evaluated on their own merits, I think.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Joshua Kalansik. I think we barely scratched the surface, so maybe we should talk again, but I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Kalansik, who's a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a fellow at the University of Southern California Center on Public Diplomacy, and a fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's also served as a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. He's the author of Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, and his latest book just out is Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. Bye for now. Time was